Good everyone, I'm Steve Lee, I'm an alcoholic. And welcome to the afternoon workshop here at Sober Vacations International. I gotta tell you that this is, in a setting like this, I'm always amazed that anybody would show up at 2 o'clock for a workshop. I've determined that you're either the desperate or the committed, or your sponsor made you do it. And I'm okay with any of those, by the way, but I appreciate, as I said the other night, that both Connie and I have been thrilled to be here this week with you guys and be a part of another SVI, and particularly grateful to be asked to participate and share with you a little bit more today. So we'll do that. Just to clarify on the front end, what I'm sure you already know, I don't suffer from any delusion that you need to hear what I have to say, but apparently I have an overwhelming need to say it, so I will travel internationally just to get a few minutes behind the microphone. But the other thing is I certainly don't purport that I'm going to instruct or teach or anything like that today. Really, just like the other night, my intention will be to simply share my experience and my perspective and my point of view, born of that experience, around what I'm going to talk about. And usually what I end up talking about is something that I need to hear. So we'll start out with that same premise that there's nothing that I'm going to share about that I feel like I've in any way mastered or have a unique or particularly insightful view into. It's just going to be, again, my experience. But let's take a moment, if you would, and we'll open with the Serenity Prayer. Serenity Prayer. God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. All right, well, I think if you looked at your program, you saw that the title of the workshop is, What Do You Mean My Character's Defective? The reason you have that cute little title is because Steve asked me to come up with a cute little title. And because workshops are hard to market on the island, you know? So you got to present it in such a way that perhaps people will be intrigued enough to come at least listen for a few moments. You may file out by the dozens in just a few minutes, but obviously, that's a little bit of code for perhaps an exploration of step 6 and 7, and even maybe a kind of touching on 4 and 5. And it's really, for me, about living this sober life after being free of alcohol a day at a time. What does this life in recovery look like? What does this design for living look like? What am I dealing with today when our literature says, and my experience confirms, that bottles were but a symptom? And I've got to begin to look inside to discover the real issues. You know, selfishness and self-centeredness is at the root of my problem. And even as we said the other night, that's certainly not limited. These are human problems. They're not strictly alcoholic problems. They seem to be especially prevalent and perhaps exaggerated in the alcoholic, but these are not unique to us. You know, that allergy to alcohol for the alcoholic is exclusive to the alcoholic. No one else has the allergy but alcoholics. If you've got the allergy, it seems like you're alcoholic. If you don't have the allergy, it seems like you're not. Doesn't make you a bad person. This means you're not alcoholic. But that second part of the first step, that unmanageability, seems to be common. It's common to the alcoholic, but it's not exclusive to the alcoholic. And so, as I said, there are 200 plus other 12-step programs that include unmanageability as a part of their first step. and the unmanageabilities in many ways what I think the 12 steps seem to treat in me. That unmanageability for me is in many ways described on page 52 in the Big Book when it talks about it calls them the bedevilments. You know, our inability to control our emotional nature, prey to misery and depression, bouts of fear, can't be of real use to other people, feelings of uselessness. Some form of those types of feelings, I don't know that that's the label I would have used or the descriptive words that I would have used before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, but as I saw them, I realized that, yeah, that's, you know, most of the time I'm feeling some version of those at varying intensities. And Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, in the 12 steps sort of begins to treat those. Workshop I did 3 years ago in Cancun had its own cute little title called Just Get Over Yourself. And it really leads into this one. And that was kind of looking at that as I sober up, and again, what I discover is that self is the problem. You know, self, this whole thing for me anyway, is this ongoing journey from self-centeredness to God-centered. From being egocentric to being God-centric, from looking at the world through my defects of character, through that prism of fear and greed and lust and envy and sloth and pride and anger. Those color my view of the world. And what I'm trying to do over time, or what seems like the result of going through the process of the steps, is to remove those things that are blocking me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. To get what Chuck Chamberlain called that new pair of glasses, and then to continue to try to dial in that prescription. You know, I've been wearing these glasses for a while, and every once in a while I go to the optometrist and he says, you know, we need to change your prescription. Things must be getting fuzzy to you again, Steve. And that happens in my spiritual life, that things will get fuzzy again on any given day. I can be viewing the world through those defects, through my fear, through my pride, through some version of those. And it will color the way I see the world, and it will color the way I respond to the world. So the fact that when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous and I begin to look at these manifestations of self, you know, what our book says right before I begin the inventory, the four-step inventory. And you know, the line that we often start with or hear quoted when we talk about the inventory is that resentment is the number one offender. And it is, I mean, I believe it is. That's a percentage. It's not, it doesn't mean that resentment's the number one problem for everyone. Percentage-wise, it seems to be the number one offender. But the line right before that in the book is the one that has sort of changed my view a little bit or become a question that I have to ask myself. And it says, being convinced that self in its various manifestations is what has defeated us, we look for its common manifestations. So that's apparently what I'm doing in the inventory process, is looking for these manifestations of self in the relationships and events and my conduct in life. That inventory is my attempt to first write down these things, but then to go look for self in them. I sometimes make it analogous to, I watch a lot of TV, and Connie and I do, but I used to really watch the CSI shows, you know, and every CSI episode starts the same. And I don't care whether it's CSI New York or New Orleans or Las Vegas or Turks and Caicos. Within the first couple of minutes, there's a dead body. And the CSI team is called to the scene. And they show up, and here is this dead body, and it looks like that this car has driven off of a bridge, fallen hundreds of feet down into a canyon, has crashed to the floor of the canyon and mangled the car and the person inside. And also burst into flames and burnt the body up. So the CSI team is there, and all the external evidence would indicate that this person died of the fall, or the fire. Everything you can see looks like this was what happened. But that's not sufficient for the CSI team. They take the body back to the lab and they do an autopsy. They cut. They go in. And they cut in, and this examination discovers and reveals that actually the man had a heart attack, which caused the wreck, which caused the fall, which caused the fire. And so it wasn't the fall or the fire that killed him, it was the heart attack. Well, my inventory is much the same way. I start writing that inventory, and I may even be right about the events that I put down on paper, that resentment, that individual, and this is what he or she did to me. And I might be accurate in my appraisal of what they did to me. And then I say what was kind of, what that worked up in me, what that impacted. But then I begin to look for the manifestation of self. What part of me did self show up anywhere in this relationship? Where did pride or ego or fear, how did anything color this relationship? Doesn't mean that I'm responsible for this thing that happened necessarily. But can I begin to look in all of my relationships for self, for a manifestation of self? And that's what the seven deadly sins are these manifestations of self. That fear, that pride, that ego, that gluttony, that lust, that anger, that sloth. And part of what I'm trying to do, you know, in the third step prayer, it says that I'm asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self. And for a long time, my view of that was I had kind of a mental picture of self holding me hostage. Or excuse me, of self being held hostage. But in fact, self is the hostage taker. I'm in the bondage of self. I'm in bondage to those external, to my human characteristics. And these instincts, all of these things that began as assets that have outgrown their usefulness and turned into liabilities. And I begin to look at these and try to determine where this showed up. Where did this flip and turn into a liability? And so it just reminds me that I'm to look inside. There's a story of a Sufi master, yet with my accent, I don't think I can talk to you about a Sufi master. So I'm just going to make it a couple of rednecks from Tennessee. But an old boy's outside in his front yard. He's lost his car keys. And he is crawling around through every blade of grass looking for these keys. And he can't find them. And a couple of his friends drive by, ask him what the problem is. And he explains to them that he's lost his keys. And they get out to help him look for the keys. And they're on their hands and knees crawling around looking for the keys. And pretty soon, a couple of more guys come by. And before you know it, there's 8 or 10 of them out there in the front yard just crawling around looking for the keys that this guy has lost, the keys to his pickup truck. And finally, one of the guys asked him a question. They say, "Now, where were you when you lost the keys?" And he said, "I was in the house." And they said, "Well, what are we doing looking out here?" He said, "Well, look, the light's so much better out here." And see, what happens to me in my life is I'll be looking out here. I'll be looking out here for the problem, and it will look like an external problem. And you will come by and ask me about my problem, and I will explain it to you with such detail, and you will be so compassionate that you will help me try to solve this external problem. But that's not the problem. I mean, what you guys shared with me from the moment I got to AA is I'm wrong about my problems. My problems aren't what I think they are. My problem is not my problem. My problem is that my problem is a problem. My problem is I've decided it's a problem. And so when money's tight, money looks like the solution to the problem. When there's a family issue, it looks like this being resolved to my satisfaction is the solution to the problem. When there's at work things aren't going well, it looks like the solution to the problem is things going well at work. People changing the way that they act or treat me or manage or whatever that is. And look, I love it when externally things line up the way I would like. I mean, I work hard to make that happen like most anybody else. But if I want to be okay right now, this moment, this very moment, then I've got to find a way to be okay with things as they are right now, in this very moment. And that requires often a level of surrender and humility that I can't conjure up. And one of the real reasons for that, as some of you heard the other night, that's kind of the cheeseburger club sandwich story. How can I be okay with what just showed up today? And it doesn't mean that I can't or shouldn't, or that you can't or shouldn't aspire to things and work hard and have plans. But what happens to me is I begin to make these demands on life and I don't even know that I've done it. It's so subtle. The 12 and 12 talks about the fact that that we all know the difference in a simple request and a demand. And I suggest to you, I absolutely know the difference in a simple request and a demand. I could explain the difference to you. What I don't recognize is when in me a request has morphed into a demand when I wasn't paying attention. That something that started as something I kind of hope will happen or hope won't happen turns into something, this cannot happen or this must happen. And when I've decided something can't or must happen, then I have greatly reduced my opportunity to be happy and comfortable in this life. I have painted myself into my own corner. I'm the author of my own misery when that happens. And by the way, it happens regularly. It'll happen, before dark today. In some area of my life, I will have wanted things to go one way. And what I've discovered, too, is that I'm wrong about what that's going to look like. I hadn't thought of this story till I was just sitting here talking, but a number of years ago, I was flying from Las Vegas to Nashville on Southwest. Now, those of you who fly Southwest, and particularly those of you who used to fly Southwest before they moved to even what is a more efficient process, used to have the deal where you would get into three queues in the A, B, and C group. And I really had a seat that I wanted to be in. I still have a seat that I want to be in. But this particular morning, it had turned into a demand. But I did everything a guy that wants to get the seat he wants on a Southwest flight needs to do. I got to the airport like 3 hours early. I checked, got in the long baggage check, because those flights from Las Vegas going east are always full. And so I got there early and checked my bag. And then, those of you who used to do that, I'm the guy that got to the gate before the gate opened up. And then I'm the first guy when the gate opens up, and then I'm the guy that got in the A queue with a book, sitting down reading, because not only do I need to be in the A group, I need to be first in the A group, or as close to first as I can get. And I've done all of this. I'm there, and I'm now first in the A group. Now, 2 hours later, so again, I've got 3 hours invested before wheels up, I'm deep off into this. But I know what I want, and I'm willing to do it. Now they're getting ready to pre-board. Now I'm watching the pre-boarders closely. I'm seeing six adults get on with 1 5-year-old, and this is ticking me off big time. How many get to get on with that kid, And I see a guy on crutches, but he doesn't look that bad to me. I don't think he needed to pre-board. This is all in my head, and I'm watching all of this. So finally, I get on, and I get the seat that I want. Now my job is to look like a guy you wouldn't want to sit next to on this flight. Because now my job is to keep this center seat vacant. Now I'm only about 10 years sober, when I'm doing this. So I've got a newspaper that I'm holding out, And I'm not making eye contact with anybody. And people are filing on, and it's working perfectly, and it's filling up. And plane is almost full, and it's worked, and I'm on the aisle, there's a center seat, and the guy over on the window seat, and directly across us, same scenario. Aisle is taken, center seat's empty, window seat is taken. They're just about to close the door, and this young couple comes on. Yeah, I'm going, I'm still not looking up, you know, and I'm not making contact, but I'm thinking, you know, somebody's going to ask me to move, and I'm not moving. I got here. I did everything God's supposed to do to get this seat, and I'm not moving. And I'm just looking in this paper, but and the guy that's sitting in the window seat next to me, he just out of nowhere, I mean, apparently this was natural to him. He said, hey, would you kids like to sit together? And the young man said, no, that, you know, you would have to move. He said, no, perfect. He said, you kids come here, take this, and I'll move over there in that center seat. And he did so. And for 3 hours, I knew I wanted to be the guy in the center seat. I know that's the guy I want to be. But my character is defective. He seemed to naturally default to that. Now, I don't know what kind of inner struggle he may have had, and maybe he just got there quicker than somebody else. But he seemed to just naturally and comfortably default to, hey, yeah, you kids sit together. Certainly that makes sense. But that's not where the selfish and self-centeredness in me, all I can think about is how hard I've worked to get what I think I want. And I got exactly what I thought I wanted. And as usually happens when I'm trying to be self-satisfied, it did not yield the appropriate result for me. I did not get. That guy got what I wanted. That guy got what our 12 and 12 calls the permanent and legitimate satisfactions of right living. And it talks about that in the 12 and 12, these permanent and legitimate satisfactions, rather than these, what it doesn't mention this, but that must mean that the flip side of that is the temporary and illegitimate satisfactions of life. And what I realize is I have and often do sacrifice these permanent legitimate satisfactions for this momentary, temporary and illegitimate satisfaction, for a self-indulgence, and to try to be self-satisfied. But self can't be satisfied. Self is insatiable, apparently. So I keep trying. I keep thinking that's going to be, and this will be it. I mean, how many times was it the, you know, the car, the shirt, the you know, whatever this thing was that I finally got what I wanted, or perhaps you got what you thought you wanted, and it has a shelf life of about half an hour, and then all of a sudden, what's next? And knowing that doesn't solve that on me, by the way. In fact, knowing it sometimes is more uncomfortable than not knowing. But that's what I'm encouraged to do, is to continue to look and explore on the inside what in me, you know, when our 10 steps suggest in the 12 and 12, that spiritual axiom, that whenever I am disturbed, there's something wrong with me. You know, that's, to my understanding, that's the only, there are only two 100% things in Alcoholics Anonymous. One is I'm encouraged I'm told that nothing seems to help the allergy to alcohol but total abstinence, 100% abstinence from alcohol. So I'm supposed, you know, for me, it's the direction and the encouragement is don't drink anything at all. Don't try to figure out how much to drink or when to drink it or what to drink it in. Just don't drink anything. It's the easiest information to understand that Alcoholics Anonymous provides me. It's not always easy to execute, particularly early on, but it's easy to understand. Don't drink anything. And then I get here all the way to the 10th step, and it says, whenever you're disturbed, 100% of the time, whenever you're disturbed, there's something wrong with you. Now, that used to seem like, it used to feel like that what was being said is I'm at fault for whatever's going on out here. This is my fault, and that's not what's being said at all. I think that the way that I apply it is just whenever I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me. And what's wrong with me is I'm disturbed. And the solution is to be undisturbed. And again, it looks like the way to be undisturbed is to solve this external circumstance to my satisfaction. But that's smoke and mirrors. That's chasing it. I mean, again, I love it when it lines up that way. And sometimes it looks like that's what happens. But if 100% of the time what I want to be is surrendered enough to be okay in this set of circumstances. And I don't mean, you know, abusive, untenable type situations, but 99% of the time that's not the problems I'm talking about. 99% of the time, it is an irritant. It is stuff. I went, you know, we're talking here about these defects of character and having, you know, kind of easing into a 6 and 7 conversation. And I'll say just about 6 or 8 months ago, I went from Nashville to Washington State, to the Ocean Shores in Washington State. And I was invited to speak on steps 6 and 7. Other people were speaking on different steps. So again, it was, you know, it's about 10 hours of travel time with layovers and change of planes. But I went, and I had to be back. So I was speaking on Saturday afternoon and then drove 2 hours to the Seattle airport and then fly back with these 2 plane changes and take a red eye, get back at like 8:30 in the morning. And so I'd spoken eloquently. They were speaking in tongues on the 6th and 7th step. And you know, 12 hours later, I get in my car in the parking garage in Nashville to go over to my home group. And as I'm leaving the airport, someone made what I deemed an inappropriate lane change. And I flipped him off and EMF'd him. And I'm thinking, so who's the guy in Washington? And who's the guy leaving the airport? And the truth is, it's the same guy. And which guy am I? I'm both guys. I'm capable of both of those at any given moment. And what I want to do is keep the meter as far over as I can toward the better part of me. But I know that I'm capable. And it doesn't mean that I was fraudulent when I was. I think I'm not being fraudulent with you today. But you know, with an audience and a microphone, I tends to bring out the best in me. You know, but a few hours from now, out on the beach, if one of you makes an improper lane change, who knows what could happen? And I hope, you know, those outbursts don't happen that often. That's a rarity. But I still get surprised. I go, whoa, where did that come from? How could that happen? Well, because it's all there. What I have is this daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And I suspect that I was a little tired and worn out, and that might have played into it. But those are the things. I just know that I'm capable of anything I've ever done again. And in fact, so when I get to 6 and 7, you know, we do that inventory and we begin to discover these things. We see this manifestation of self, how it's shown up in these relationships and events of my life. And so I then do a 5th step and I talk with my sponsor and I share these things and we have a give and take. And frankly, at that point, I have more information about me than I have ever had. Probably I have the humility, as it is described in the 5th step in the 12 and 12, it's described as a clear understanding of who and what I am right now, coupled with a sincere desire to be what I could be. And so that's where I kind of land coming through the 5th step. I've got this information. I've taken a look. I see things about me I could not see before. And the question becomes in the 6th step, after kind of reviewing those first 5 proposals, it says, if I've decided these things are objectionable, am I willing to have God remove them? And it says, if so, then we go on to the 7th step prayer. If there's anybody here that's newer, I'll warn you that Alcoholics Anonymous has a couple of bait and switch moments in it. And this is one of them. There's another one, by the way, it's all the way back on page 164 is the first time that our book says we realize we know only a little. You know, I mean that, and I think they were wise not to lead with that. And so basically I'm going through this book and they're getting to the back and they're going, you know what, we've been winging it, man. We're doing the best we can and I hope it's been helpful to you and we're probably going to learn more as we go along. And so today I realize all these years later that I know only a little and more will be disclosed as I draw near to Him. But the bait and switch, the other bait and switch moment leading into this is around the third step. Because the third step, you know, it leads me into that third step prayer. And it's after the prayer that it says, we thought well before taking this important step. And I said, what do you mean, man? I took it already, you know. What's going to happen now, you know. I did not think well before taking it. And asking ourselves if we are ready to abandon ourselves utterly to him. Well, there's nothing ambiguous about that language. Abandon ship, abandon self utterly to him. Go from self-centered to God-centered. And what that looks like for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, particularly early on, is am I ready to follow this design for living rather than my design for living? Rather than taking the action based on the way that I see the world and the way it feels to me and the way that it looks to me, am I ready to take actions just based on what the black print says in the book? Am I willing to just take these actions even though it looks like it's not going to work out very well for me? It's scary. You know, you're asking me to take a leap of faith. But Alcoholics Anonymous is a little different than most, at least for me, what it feels like looking back at it is what happens at that third step in Alcoholics Anonymous is that you, it's like showing up at a bridge across a big ravine. And it's kind of a pedestrian bridge that's, you know, the rope is frayed and the wood is rotted on the bridge slats going across. And you guys are on the other side of the bridge, you know, saying, come on over. Now, well, look, it doesn't look like it's going to hold me. I'm afraid to take this step. I'm afraid to abandon self utterly to him. And you're saying, no, look, Steve, I know it's scary, but it held us, it'll hold you. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we do something a little different. In Alcoholics Anonymous, you come back across the bridge and meet me. And we go together. We don't send people on solo missions in Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I end up at that sixth step and it says, hey, if you've done this inventory and you've arrived with some defects of character, some self-identified defects of character, it says if you find these objectionable, then we'll go to the seventh step and humbly ask God to remove them. But then I get to the seventh step prayer, and that's where the bait and switch is, right? Because in the seventh step prayer, it says, you know, my creator, I'm now ready that you should have all of me, good and bad. I'm ready for you to take every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. So I think I'm just taking this little package of things that I've identified and looks like I'm willing to give this up. But it's really saying I got to put it, this is where I'm encouraged to put everything on the table. And it's sort of like having a yard sale. And, you know, in the yard sale, you go through your house and the garage and the attic, and you are looking for all those items that are now clutter, that are in the way, that no longer have use, that might be in the way of something else that might be more useful. And I'm gathering those things. And then I'm getting ready to take them out into the front yard. Then Saturday morning, they'll come by and, you know, I'll mark them way down and then they'll take them. But what this would seem to suggest is following that analogy on out, that when they come over on Saturday morning to go through the stuff in the front yard, that I've got to go, you know what? Go on in the house, and if there's anything there you need, take it too. Because I'm not sure what I'm supposed to have and what I'm not supposed to have. You know, I hope you'll leave the recliner and the big screen because I am fond of those. But I'm supposed to say, yeah, take, you know, God, here it is. It feels like a continuation, a deeper surrender of that third step. It is now, having done four and five, with this information going, I'm all in. I'm putting it all in the game, because it says this is what separates the boys from the men, you know, that the adults from the kids. This is where I'm encouraged to put away childish things and act based again on this God-centered, on this principle-centered life, rather than this constant need to be self-satisfied. And it's just almost embarrassing for me to have this conversation today with Connie in the audience, because she sees me regularly attempt to be self-satisfied, whether that is shopping. You know, we were out to eat, and this falls into defective character as well, but I was about 6 years sober, and we went out to eat one night, and I was feeling pretty good about me, you know. That happens occasionally, and I don't know exactly how the conversation, where I started, but I think I was fishing for a compliment. And kind of saying, you know, how I was doing pretty good. I felt like things were going well, and we were sober, and I was doing pretty good. And she said, and not being angrily, but just as an observation, she said, "Well, you know, you're still one of the most deceitful people that I know." And I said, "You know, I wasn't going for that, honey. That was, and instead of doing what I might typically do and fire back, take my best shot on what, let me tell you what I hadn't been telling you that's clearly true about you. Instead of firing back, I said, "Why do you say so? You know, in this case." And she went, "Well," she said, "you know, you say you're at work when you've gone to a movie, you know, because she'll find a movie stubbed in my pants pocket." I said, "You know, you're grown up. You can go to a movie if you want to go to a movie." But I was lying about where I was from time to time. "Since you got a little money, you got a little slush fund of money that you think I don't know about, you know, but doesn't everybody?" And she said, "And this is the one that still plagues me." She says, "And you'll go out and buy some clothes." And this was particularly at a time when we were trying, you know, when we were conversationally saying we're watching our money. "And then I'll go out and buy something," and she said, "you'll tear the tags off and try to slip them into the rotation unnoticed, you know?" And yeah, you know, and so what I've got to do is look at that and go, so is that true? Do I care? And if I care, am I willing to give that up? Because if I give that up, that means I can't do it. If I give that up, I've got to, you know, so it means I might have to do without something I think I want. In fact, I think I need. We have that conversation sometimes. So navigating through this stuff is real grown-up stuff, I think, for me and perhaps for you. One of the things that I do pretty regularly and I've bragged about is I said I'm never the first car at a red light. I said, the car in front of me makes it, I can make it, you know? Sometimes it's yellow, sometimes it's red, but if he made it, I can make it. I'm close on his tail. If they hit us, they're really going to hit him. And I've been known to turn left where it says no left turn. I don't do it. I wouldn't endanger anybody. I mean, I assess the situation. I make sure there's no oncoming traffic. But I've decided I'm bigger than the rules. So we were, in November, we were in Atlanta at a friend of ours' daughter's wedding. We're leaving Saturday morning. We've had breakfast with the wedding party as we're leaving the hotel. I pulled out to the end of the parking lot of the hotel, and I didn't know it was there till we got there, but there was a sign that said no left turn. And I said, "Hey, there's no traffic, big deal, doesn't mean me probably," and I turned left. And I spent the next 10 hours in jail. And handcuffed and taken in, and there's a whole series of things that led to that. In fact, there were other defects of character that played into it. The reason I got arrested is because my driver's license was suspended. I did not know that. My driver's license was suspended because I had gotten a citation 6 months before for an expired tag. I did know that. I had paid it, but my tags had expired 6 months before that. What I'm saying is I made multiple decisions based on self, which later put me in a position to be hurt. What I can tell you is that I now don't turn left when it says no left turn, because I don't want to pay that price anymore. And that's true with most of these defects of character. I didn't stop drinking because I'm alcoholic. I stopped drinking because of the consequences of my drinking. The consequences of that alcoholism got too painful that ultimately I want to do something different. My defects of character are very much the same way. You know, and our book says a great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that one day he will control and enjoy his drinking. I would contend, at least certainly in my case, that the great obsession of me is that one day I will control and enjoy my defects of character. As I told you before, I didn't want to stop drinking completely before I got to AA, but I wanted to drink just enough to get what everything alcohol did for me without suffering the pains of what it did to me. And I would say in some of these defects of character, I think I want to revel in them just to the point that they sort of, that I get some temporary self-satisfaction. But I don't want to go to jail for 10 hours, so I'm going to quit turning left to where it says no left turn. But what about these other areas of my life? Where am I hurting me? Where am I limiting my spiritual growth? Where am I impacting and doing collateral damage to the people around me? Am I really willing to change? What would letting go really look like? What would that abandoning self really look like on a guy like me? You know, and here's the thing. You can't do this, or I can't do this, on self-will. I can't will my defects of character away. And this was, and maybe for some of you, certainly it had been a puzzle for me for quite a while to try to figure out, what's my role? What is my role in the sixth and seventh step? You know, the 12 and 12 says that if these steps and God were able to remove my drinking 100%, why can't it do the same thing for my defects of character? It says this is the riddle of our existence. We may never know the answer. But the answer, I believe, amongst other things, is because that is my human frailty. That's the humanness in me. So I can't decide not to have some of these defects. I think what I'm encouraged to do is act like a guy would act if he did not have them. Now there's a limited shelf life of self-will. I just say that kind of what happens when I get to AA and I'm just barely new, maybe I go to the grocery store and there's someone in the, you know, express lane with too many items. And I have no alternative but to snatch them up, slap them around, and send them to the right aisle, you know, especially if it's an elderly woman. Because anybody I'm, you know, most people I'd be afraid of. But, and you guys say, that's bad behavior, Steve. You can't do that, man. We don't act like that around here. So the next time I'm in line, same situation, same person, same number of items, and I don't say a word. I just sit there, stand there. But I'm about to implode from not saying a word. You know, I am just, and so I'm not free of that defect of character. I'm suffering from that defect of character, but I'm not causing any collateral damage with it. And what you've told me to do is to act my way into right thinking, that through that self-sacrifice, sacrificing self, standing there quietly, that I might one day find myself in line not even counting the items. And so you guys have said from the day I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous to act my way into right thinking, to act as if. And I prefer act as if to fake it till you make it. Fake it till you make it. I got no problem with others with fake it till you make it, but I've been faking it all my life. And act as if means, at least in my case, is I act like a guy would act if he wasn't impatient. I try to act like a guy would act if he were honest. I try to act like a guy would act if he weren't prideful. I try to act like that, but I don't pretend to be that person. I share with my sponsor and with the people close to me that this is killing me. This is hard. This is hard work. But I'm going to act like this. And that profound, that spiritual experience that our book talks about and describes back in the Appendix 2 is a profound alteration in my reaction to life. I begin to respond differently to life. And it's not because I got smarter, and it's not because I got more virtuous. I believe, at least, it is because there has been an internal change, that spiritual experience, that through the process of being willing to sacrifice self, this willingness, you know, willingness, that our book says, the 12 and 12 says, willingness is the key. Willingness is the key to all of this. Honesty is necessary. And open-mindedness is necessary, but if I'm honest and open-minded but unwilling, we don't go anywhere. Nothing happens. And willingness is described or defined at least one place that I looked up as doing, because I was 18 years sober before I looked it up. And it is defined as doing that which I would not do as a matter of course. And see, that makes perfect sense to me, because there's nothing AA's asked me to do that I was just about to do before I got here. There's not a single direction or suggestion that's been given me that I was saying, oh, I was just going to try that. So it is required an act of will. Our book really says, you know, when we say lack of power is our dilemma, it doesn't say lack of power is our problem. It says lack of power is our dilemma. And I looked up dilemma, also at 18 years sober. And dilemma is a problem with two equally unacceptable solutions. A dilemma is, I don't know what to do. A dilemma at that second and third step is whether to die an alcoholic death or live life on a spiritual basis. I'd prefer not to do either one when I got here. I don't want to die and I don't want to live this spiritual life. What's behind door number three? But there's not one. So that's a dilemma. I'm not crazy about either. What am I going to do? So this lack of power, and it says that lack of willpower had not been our problem. It is the misuse of willpower that has been our problem. My problem before I get to AA is I've been using all my willpower against my problem. I've been trying to attack my alcoholism, both my drinking and change who I am by an act of will. And it's insufficient. I don't have the necessary power. No human power does. But I think what I'm being encouraged to do is redirect my willpower toward the solution, away from the problem. Because I want to come at the problem. What Alcoholics Anonymous suggests I do is turn my willpower toward this relationship with God and a higher power. Quit trying to solve this problem. Start trying to build this relationship, and this problem will go away. This problem will die of neglect. This problem will cease to be a problem. Because when I am, and that connection, that again, all of this is kind of instantaneous. I've heard a lot of people say that fear and faith can't reside in the same space. And I don't have a clue whether they can or whether they can't. But I can promise you they can change places instantaneously and several times a day. I can be okay at 10 in the morning, and I can be wrapped around the axle at noon. And then I got to remind myself, oh yeah, I'm trusting, I'm living a life on a different basis, our book says, the basis of trusting infinite God rather than my finite self. Oh, I forgot, I keep thinking I'm in it alone. I keep thinking it won't be okay. I keep thinking I won't be okay. And that's really the end game. This faith we talk about isn't that if I'm faithful enough, everything will work out all right. The faith is I'll be all right no matter how things work out. And it's a real different take for me. So I show up with these defects of character, and my sponsor in Richmond, Virginia said, Steve, this is not where you're going to get perfect. This is where you come to grips with your imperfection. This is where you come to grips with your humility. This is where you come to grips with the fact that how can you find a way to be okay as you are right now, as imperfect as you are, with these flaws that you have. And he wasn't demeaning me at all. It's just that we all have those things. And how often does a guy like me and perhaps you sit in a meeting and hear somebody else talking and going, man, I can't wait till I get there. I can't wait till I grow there. Well, what about today? See, today is the day that I want to have a good day. And I realize that I've spent so much of my time in life, not just Alcoholics Anonymous, but getting ready to have a good day. You know, you can almost see it from here as soon as. I mean, even here, something can get in my way. It can be too hot. I can complain about there's not enough you can do for me to self-satisfy me. until I get, till I'm connected to that higher power in a way that lets me know, oh yeah, no, everything is all right just the way it is. I'm okay. So that's really where I'm going to end it here today. And Steve and I were talking yesterday that we were both at the first Far Corners retreat that Sandy Beach held down in Florida. And I guess that was 10, 12 years ago. I don't remember exactly. And I was having I was in kind of a flat spot and having kind of a down time. And I really only, the opportunity for me to go just opened up a couple of days before the retreat. And I called Connie and asked her if it was okay if I went. And Lee had actually, I'd seen it on his website that this thing was going on. And she said, yeah, and I went down there. And during one of the breaks on Saturday afternoon, I was invited to go on a walk with Sandy and Bob B. through, it was a prayer walk, and each little station had one of the verses of the prayer of St. Francis, and you would stop and contemplate that and then move to the next. And we're going through there, and I'm listening to these two guys who I respect and admire so much talk to each other. And then I started talking to them about a few things, and things that I felt were, that bothered me about me. And Sandy grabbed me. I've heard him say this to large audiences and perhaps one-on-one, but he said what I have to remember today on any given day. He said, Steve, you're already okay, and you're the one that doesn't know it. And I would say that to you. I believe that we're already okay. Doesn't mean that we don't want to continue to grow. It doesn't mean that I don't want to challenge myself down this spiritual path. If there's nothing, I'm okay. But I'm fairly average. You know, I called my mother. I talked to my mom after I was sober a number of years. And I said, Mom, we're talking about something. And I said, it's finally clear to me that I'm just an ordinary alcoholic. And she said, yes, Stephen, but you're extraordinarily ordinary. You know, but just gives me, even there, you know, so like when all the ordinary people gather, I'm the most ordinary. And but see, I just, you know, and our book calls it being a man among men. You know, can I just be one of God's kids? And I can. But I see that illustration that Chamberlain would draw with that circle. And the little dot outside of it. And you say, that's me. That's how so many of us view ourselves. There's this whole little thing, and I'm just outside the circle. And so what Alcoholics Anonymous asked me to do, what you guys helped me do, what I endeavor to do in my own clumsy, half-hearted way, is to build this relationship with a higher power and be freer of the bondage of self. Because the only thing standing in the way of my relationship with you is me. And the only thing standing in the way of my relationship with God is me. And these steps are designed to reduce that ego, to reduce that self-centeredness, so I can be a part of this larger whole. So I can be one of God's kids in God's world and connect with people in a real way and not in a superficial way. Thanks so much for giving me your time and attention. I guess we'll close with the Lord's Prayer.